Good morning and welcome. My name is David Blair, and it is my pleasure to welcome you to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum with today's guest speaker, Dr. Carl Kaiser. For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has been bringing outstanding world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as a catalyst to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. After the presentation, in keeping with Lyceum tradition, the speaker has agreed to answer questions from the audience. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is supported entirely through contributions from our audience members. Thank you for your generous support. Our speaker today is Carl Kaiser. Dr. Kaiser directed and is now a senior associate of the Program on Transatlantic Relations of Harvard's Weatherhead Center for International Affairs. He was, until last month, adjunct professor of public policy at the Kennedy School. Carl has written about 50 books in the fields of world affairs, foreign policy, transatlantic and East-West relations. He has advised German chancellors Brandt and Schmidt and has worked closely with Henry Kissinger. Since 2008, he has been a citizen of the U.S. Carl marries academic and political experience. This gives him unusual depth and breadth in his understanding of Europe and indeed the world. Carl also married Debbie Strong. Her father, Jonathan, sponsored the first Cambodian refugees who settled in Peterborough in the 1980s. Jonathan was father and grandfather to their children and grandchildren. On his visits to Jonathan's home, Carl might find Cambodian men rehearsing with their rock band in the garage, while their children played in the garage, in the yard, and women prepared a meal in the kitchen. He has followed these families and their stories for decades. So the refugee experience is for him not just academic and political, but personal. He brings his mind and his heart to the question of the refugee crisis in Europe. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Carl Kaiser.
Last year, the picture of a small boy lying face down, drowned, washed up on the shores of a Greek island moved us all, as did the tracks of thousands of men, women, and children traversing the Balkans and overwhelming the railway stations of Hungary, of Austria, and of Germany. We have been concerned and still are concerned about the debate in our own country about excluding groups of people from coming to this country, from abandoning our policy of openness to refugees, or about Mr. Trump's suggestion to expel 11 million of our fellow human beings from the United States. Many believe that these are temporary problems that will somehow be resolved in the near future. My contention is that this is only the overture of a much larger, a deeper, indeed a global crisis. A crisis that is going to stay with us for years, and that will challenge, in particular, the United States as an immigration country, as the world's largest power, and indeed as the leader of the Western democratic world. Refugees arrived in unprecedented numbers since World War II last year. And we talk about migrants and refugees, and let me clarify first that these are not the same. Migrants are people who cross an international border or are internally displaced for all kinds of reasons, for example, economic reasons. Refugees are persons defined by the Convention on Refugees of 1951. These are people who live outside their country and who have a justified fear of being persecuted for reasons of race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or because they belong to a particular social group, and who cannot be protected in their country of origin, and who have to fear that they will be persecuted if they return. That is a refugee according to the Convention of 1951 and the Protocol which the United States ratified. And once they are refugees, and it's the UN, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, that registers them, once they are refugees, they enjoy certain rights. They must be helped. They cannot be sent back to the countries they come from. Many migrants come, but not all of them are refugees. Of the 1.3 million that arrived in Europe last year, probably three quarters will end up being refugees, recognized refugees. In 2015, the increase was dramatic. In July, 80,000. The previous year, 2014, roughly every month, 20 to 30,000 arrived. In September, 170,000. In October, 240,000. In November, 150,000. A total of about 1.3 million people arrived in Europe, 50% of them Syrians, 20% Afghans, and 7% Iraqis. They were fleeing from the civil war of Syria, from Assad's barrel bombs, from the fights of the various factions inside Syria. They were fleeing from the horrors of ISIS and from the terror of the Taliban in Afghanistan. And they were also leaving the refugee camps around Syria, in Turkey, in Lebanon, and in Jordan, where in 2015, the UNHCR, which tries to take care of the refugees, had to half the rations for food, so that the almost all already unbearable circumstances in those camps became even worse, and they decided to risk their lives crossing the waters, and roughly 3,800 people died trying to come to Europe. And they put themselves at the mercy of smugglers who exploit their desperation, taking the savings from them anywhere between $5,000 and $100,000. $5,000 for a simple passage across the water, $100,000 if you want to have an airplane ticket and a false passport, and to be accompanied until the point of where you want to go. That sounds like a very irrational decision to risk lives, but it is a very rational decision when you consider that staying means you might get killed by the jihadists or by the barrel bombs. In July last year, the circumstances became pretty chaotic. Registration was almost impossible. Order broke down. Imagine 5 to 10,000 people arriving in South Station in Boston every day, and they have to be taken care of. Under these circumstances, Chancellor Merkel in August decided to open the border, no longer to go through the registration. And she said her famous words, "We can do it," watching the scenes of chaos and desperation. She has been criticized a great deal for taking this decision, which she took unilaterally without consulting the European Union. But the European Union had failed to follow her suggestion and the suggestion of other European leaders to have a common policy. They decided to distribute 120,000 in June, and 1,000 were distributed. So the situation was at that moment pretty desperate. And only 3 days ago, Chancellor Merkel actually responding to the incidents in Germany lately, she reconfirmed, and I want to quote this, she reconfirmed her policy. "Today, as in the past, I am convinced that we can do it. To live up to our historic task, which is a historic test in the age of globalization, we can do this. A rejection of the humanitarian stance we took could have led to even worse consequences. Indeed, one could argue a rich country like Germany, with its very past that it has, rejecting and being passive while 100,000 people are sort of piling up at the border, would of course unleash an enormous amount of criticism. So in that sense, she was acting in the national interest of the country and of Europe in that sense. But on top of it, she had moral reasons, because she said, if we were to refuse the refugees, this would not be my country. So in the meantime, order has descended, some kind of order. The chaos is no longer what it used to be. But I think to realize for Americans what 1 million people means, America is four times as large as Germany, it would mean that America takes 4 million people in. 4 million people in 1 year. What are the real figures of America? Just to remind you, America took in 2014 1.3 million people, immigrants, 1.3 million. Out of these 1.3 million, 70,000 were refugees, 70,000. So the last 3 years, actually each year, 70,000 refugees. To give an idea of the order of magnitude of the problem which the people then had at that moment. When 10,000 people arrive every day in one train station, Munich in this case, imagine New York and Boston would be the place where every day 10, 20,000 come through. They had to organize special trains, several a day, hire private buses, and ship them all over the country, which meant that the ministries and politicians had to come to some agreement on what to do. But they just had to force the communities to take them. It's like Peterborough, 5,000 inhabitants, gets a call. Tonight there will be four buses with 400 people. Take care of them. House them, feed them, take care of their medical needs. That's what happened all over the country. It somehow managed. I visited with friends, with American friends, one of those centers in Berlin, a former townhouse, of which there are quite a few of these centers in the city. And when it started, they had 950 volunteers, of whom now 350 work 24/7 in that center, with about three or four people paid. And the whole thing would not have worked without the volunteers. I mean, that is clear. Although the public administration was totally overwhelmed, as would any country be overwhelmed. I mean, this country would be overwhelmed if you had 4 million people suddenly coming in. So things have greatly improved, but the task is enormously difficult. The refugees or migrants are people not speaking the language. They come from a very different culture. There are lots of children. There are 300,000 children had to be put in school within 1 year. That is 1.2 million children being put in American schools. So just to give the order of magnitude that is taking place here. What is happening is really quite extraordinary. And I invite you all to watch what's happening in Sweden, which is the other country that takes lots. In Sweden and in Germany, it's a spectacular process of social engineering. It would completely change the countries. Germany already today, like Sweden, has a large share of migrants. 20% of Germans today have a migrant background. In 2014, Germany was the second most immigration country after the United States. But these are people that are very different. And their integration is going to be quite a challenge. Whether it will work, we will see. Of course, there are problems. What are they? There's the rise of the extreme right that uses the immigration issue, like in this country. You have the Front National in France, the Freedom Party of Mr. Wilders in the Netherlands, and in Germany, the Alternative for Germany. They're all popping up now in Germany for the first time. It is a party. They just got into some regional parliaments, and they're likely to get into the federal parliament. Are they threatening democracy? I don't think so. It will not threaten democracy. Although they succeeded in getting the British to vote for leaving the European Union. It was the anti-immigration feeling and the lies being told by the Leave campaign that 75 million Turks would now suddenly arrive in Britain that induced many Brits to vote for leaving. But it doesn't threaten British democracy, nor will it threaten, in my opinion, French democracy, because at the end, the other parties will always unite against a Marine Le Pen as a candidate. Terrorism, is there a problem there? We must keep in mind that Europe has a terrorism problem totally unrelated to refugees, because Europe has sent lots of ISIS fighters to ISIS, about 1,000 Frenchmen with a French passport, and about 400 to 500 Germans and other countries too. And they are, of course, a danger if they come back. So that exists anyhow. And the great and horrible incidents that we had in France and Belgium, they were committed not by refugees. There was a link to some refugees, but they were homegrown terrorists that grew up in those countries. And the three incidents that Germany had last week, two of them were refugees. One of them, the mass shooter of Munich, was an Iranian German who had grown up in Germany, who tried, actually, a deranged mind, who tried to copy American school shootings, mass shootings, and also the Norwegian one. So there is a link, and of course one has to be careful. And as these incidents happen, the authorities, of course, trying to improve their methods to prevent them. The numbers have gone down, and have partially gone down because of a deal that the European Union, and with a great involvement of Angela Merkel, made with Turkey. And the deal is the Turks will get free visa travel, 3 billion immediately, to be doubled later, in exchange for accepting all illegal, or let's say, migrants who cannot be refugees, and of taking back Syrians who have the right to refugee status, but sending them then into the European Union. Interestingly, the numbers have gone down, although the agreement is not yet really working very well. And the question now, of course, is what after the coup in Turkey is going to happen. Already before, there was a great deal of criticism that the European Union could make a deal with a country that was increasingly repressing human rights. And now after the coup, it has become worse. So that remains to be seen. But in any case, the numbers have gone down, partially because of the deal, partially because the countries on the Balkan route closed their borders, so that the problem sort of becomes manageable in Germany for the very reasons that Angela Merkel and the German government criticized before, namely closing the border. Of course, the refugee problem threatens the European Union and the cohesion of the European Union, and after the British decision to leave, things will get more difficult as a result. Nevertheless, the European Union has a long history of crises, really big crises, and every time emerged with some kind of reform which managed. The euro crisis, you may remember a few years ago, led many people to believe that's the end of the European Union. It isn't. And it will continue in some way or another. The Europeans are too much tied to each other and integrated to be able to afford a separation. The flow is now redirected to the south. They are now coming from Africa. Since the beginning of this year, 260,000 people have arrived in Italy, Greece, and Spain, primarily Italy, but also Greece, and few in Spain. But as the French defense minister said, 800,000 are waiting in Libya. And Libya is a failed state, and we don't know what the future will bring. It's a very risky way of traversing the Mediterranean, and already now many people have drowned. Is there an impact on the United States? Despite Secretary of State Kerry's remark at the Munich Security Conference, it is our problem. The impact has been only indirect. Of course, it has reinforced Mr. Trump's anti-immigrant rhetoric. He actually said that Angela Merkel is ruining Germany. It has led President Obama to promise to take 20,000. So far, 2,400 have arrived. Most Republican governors have refused to take any Syrian refugee, despite the fact that the vetting process of the United States is really very, very thorough. That's the reason why there are only 70,000 a year, considering that there are so many waiting would like to come here. The Canadians, incidentally, took 29,000. The refugee crisis is a global crisis, yet we don't perceive it as a global crisis yet. Why? Partially because 9% of the refugees of the world actually live in our countries, in the rich countries, like the US, Germany, Britain, France, Japan, very few in Japan. And 91% live in poor countries. That has to be remembered. The countries that can afford it least have most refugees. Jordan has 700,000 to 1 million. Ethiopia, 750. Iran, 1 million. Turkey, about 3. Lebanon, between 1 and 2. Pakistan, 1.6. To them, of course, our problems here or in Europe are enormous. But the really enormous problems are outside. They're there, not here. There are a number of drivers of this movement of migration, which is a global process now. And these drivers will perpetuate the migration movement and make it worse in the coming years. First, of course, the spread of civil war, of conflict, the kinds of wars that are partially religious, and we know from European history they are always the bloodiest, the regional rivalries in the Middle East, the Arab-Israeli conflict. There is almost a structural absence of peace in the Middle East, and that produces migrants and refugees. Second, the spread of repression. Look around the world. How many democracies do we have? How much repression does actually exist? Repression of human rights all over the place. And that, again, produces refugees, military dictatorship in particular. Third, climate change. Climate change will displace millions of people as it gets worse as a result of coastal erosion and flooding and because of severe drought. Iran has lost most of its rivers. The water table in the Middle East is so low you can barely get any water out of it. Agricultural territory is being reduced. The food supply will suffer. Conflict will arise and conflict produces migrants. Fourth, there is an amazing desire, but not an astonishing desire, to leave and go north. According to a Gallup World Poll, 1/5 of all people asked in North Africa and the Middle East would like to move permanently or for some time north to Europe. For Morocco, Turkey and Egypt, that would mean 21 million. Keep in mind, 50% of the population of Northern Africa and of the Middle East is under 30. They have no hope, unemployment. They want to go to Europe. And unlike preceding waves of migration, these migrants and potential migrants, they are informed. They have iPhones and tablets, and their views may be distorted, but it's a very different way of looking to another part of the world. In the past, they just stayed where they were. Now they want to leave. The consequence is as follows. The international regime that we have created in the immediate post-war period, in 1951, the convention, that was intended to deal with the refugees in Europe of that time, producing an automatic right for everybody. Nobody thought of the phenomenal destabilization of the rest of the world, which would produce millions of migrants. So the regime is no longer working properly. Is there a way out? Are there solutions? I would say yes. We cannot afford to take in Europe the same numbers as Europe did in 2015. America can take more. The Germans cannot take another million, but America can take more than 70,000, obviously. But they can only be taken in an orderly, managed, reasonable way, where the numbers are reduced and the system that integrates them can integrate them. Second, we have to accept that the automatic protection provided by the Refugee Convention to everybody who corresponds to the criteria that are listed can no longer be given. It is not possible. The integration capacity, the reception of the receiving countries is too limited. Not all of them. Some of them could take more, but some of them cannot take more without endangering social stability in their countries, which means that the convention has to be adapted. Criteria have to be developed to take into account the situation, which is no longer the situation of the late 40s and early 50s, where you had only refugees in Europe. Third, we must fundamentally revise the system of supporting refugees. They are now helped by the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. That has to deal with 21 million refugees in camps that it administers, more or less, where there are horrible conditions, partially, And what many people don't know, it's entirely based on voluntary contributions. There's no budget, which means that the UN organization, which deals with one of the most important and pressing problems of world politics, has to go around with a begging bowl, doesn't have a budget, like all the other organizations. This can and should be changed. Fourth, a paradigm change will be necessary of our policy of dealing with the origins of migration, of creating circumstances which help people to stay and not to leave and create the problems that I have described. If the North doesn't help the South to improve the living conditions, the South will come to the North. Now, of course, we can solve it in the fashion that Donald Trump likes to do. We can close the border, build walls, lock down, apart from the economic damages that we are doing to ourselves. This would undermine the very character of our liberal and humane democracies. Three things, in my opinion, are necessary. First, we need a massive, and I repeat, massive, change of development policy in order to help countries to create conditions so that people can stay and have a future there. We have agreed decades ago that each country in the OECD, the Organization of the Wealthy Countries, will devote 0.7% of the gross national product to development aid. What have we done in reality? The figures of last year. The UK actually fulfilled it, 0.7%. France, 0.37%. Germany, 0.5%. Denmark is above, 0.8%. Norway is even giving 1% of its GNP to development aid. And Sweden is the champion, giving 1.4% of the GNP. The United States, 0.17%. A rich country like the United States is at the bottom of the list. If all OECD countries had, since 2002, really reached 0.7% of their GNP, it would have added $2 trillion, additional dollars, that we could have used for development aid and to prevent people from leaving their countries. There is a second thing we can do. We can slow down the climate change, which will be the inevitable accelerator of migration, massive migration. We will see more in the future as it proceeds. That means you have to contradict and fight the climate change deniers. We have to. And we have to prevent the Paris Climate Agreement that was concluded by the United States with 190 other countries will not be ripped apart on the first day of another president in office. Third, finally, we must continue an active policy of preventing conflict and of ending conflict in other parts of the world which produce the waves of migration by active diplomacy, by helping countries, if necessary, by military intervention, which means that for the United States, as the most powerful country in the world, a policy of isolation, which is preached by some, or of denial of global interdependence, which is also preached by some, is no rational alternative for this country. Is there hope that we'll do the right thing? 2 points here to conclude. Next September, a special session of the UN General Assembly will take place on refugees and migration for the first time in the history of the United Nations. So at least there is a recognition that this is a global problem that requires solutions, global solutions, and that all members of the United Nations have to act. And then finally, there are elections in the United States of America this coming November, as you know. And these elections will decide whether the United States will be a sensible world leader in working out a better and more effective policy on migration and on refugees, or whether the United States will withdraw into Fortress America and let chaos reign outside. Thank you very much. Ah, thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Kaiser.